punishment for small infractions by the guard, and according to him, it had been surprisingly effective. Kelsey could ask Brenner about Macy's origins, perhaps, but she couldn't imagine that the albino would be willing to tell her anything. She had considered bringing Brenner down here today, but in the end decided that such a move would be too cruel. Now she wished she had done it, just to see the look on Thorne's face. Maddening to have so many questions to which the answers were hidden by a single pitiless mind. Kelsey was pleased to see that you in size, at least, was an advantage here. After they stopped the wagon, Ewan held Thorne's arms tightly while Elston dealt with the knots. Normally it would have been Kib with Elston, as always, but Mace was still testing Kib, trying to analyze what had changed since his illness. Kib was different. Even Kelsey could see it. He sang less, laughed less, seemed more introspective. From time to time, Kelsey would catch him staring at her, puzzled, as though trying to decipher some code that only the two of them understood. At the foot of the scaffold, Kelsey dismounted and headed up the stairs to the platform, surrounded by her guard. The crowd howled around her, a sound for nightmares, but she no longer minded, for the cacophony fit her mood. After months spent hunting for Thorne, this should have been her day of triumph. But somehow, everything had gone wrong. Thorne had not stood trial, and Kelsey could feel Carlin's certain disapproval like a low headache at the back of her mind. 8 days ago, the Mort had crossed the Crythe, and no amount of ingenuity from Hall or Bermond could hold back their numbers. Soon, Kelsey would have to evacuate the sprawling camp outside the city and move the refugees inside. Whenever she closed her eyes now, she saw the Mort, a faceless black horde, waiting at the end of the New London Bridge. What did they wait for? Kelsey shrank from the answer. She beckoned her herald, Jordan, who had hung back from the group of Queen's guards, in clear discomfort. The guards were not unkind to him, certainly, but there was little doubt that Jordan was a mouse among hawks. See if you can get them to settle down. Jordan moved to the front of the scaffold and began yelling, waving his arms. His deep voice was strong enough to make the wood thrum beneath Kelsey's feet, but still it took a few minutes for the crowd to fall into an uneasy silence, one broken by hisses and muttering. Elston and Ewan had moved Thorne to the pinnacle of the scaffold, where he stood with bound hands, staring far over the crowd. "Arlan Thorne, Brother Matthew, and Liam Banneker." Kelsey was pleased to hear her words ring across the circus and bounce back again from the wall of pubs. "You are guilty of treason, and the Crown has sentenced you to death. Should you have anything to say before you hang, the Crown is listening." For a moment, she thought that Thorne might speak. He scanned the crowd, and Kelsey knew without knowing that he was looking for Brenner, for the damnable albino who had such an incomprehensible hold on him. "Speak, Arlan." But he said nothing, and then the moment was past. Kelsey felt it blow right by her, a cold wind of withered promise. "Beast!" a woman screamed, and then they all began again, howling and cursing. There was nothing more to accomplish here. Kelsey nodded to Mace and Corin, who stepped forward without ceremony, and shoved both Banneker and the priest off the scaffold. Banneker's neck broke instantly, a quick crack like a slap, and his limp body swung back and forth in decreasing arcs before the crowd. But Brother Matthew struggled, choking against his noose. The crowd had begun to fling items again, making a game of it now, trying to hit the two dangling men. Most of these objects bounced harmlessly off the wooden facing, but one piece fell near Kelsey with a dull crack, a misshapen brick, its edges worn. Beside the brick, a playing card lay face down on the platform, no doubt left by some worker on break from construction. Not knowing why, Kelsey bent down and picked it up. Turning it over, she saw that it was the Queen of Spades. Kelsey stared at the card, transfixed. A tall woman dressed in black, holding weapons in both hands. The Queen's all-knowing gaze pinned Kelsey where she stood, as though she knew every thought in Kelsey's mind. But no, Kelsey thought, that isn't it at all. The knights are slicing her own flesh open, the incident with Kib, the steadily growing sense of her own power. All of it had been narrowing to a point, distilling Kelsey to her essentials. She squeezed her hand into a fist, feeling the playing card crumple inside. I am her, the tall dark woman with death in each hand. She is me.
Be silent, she shouted.
A hush fell over the crowd, as quick and sharp as a curtain dropping. Brother Matthew still convulsed, gagging at the end of his rope. But Kelsey didn't mind the counterpoint. She moved up toward the edge of the scaffold, so far out that Penn, close as always, grabbed a handful of her dress. It felt as though there were yards of extra material in the small of Kelsey's back now, where the fabric had always stretched tight for her entire life. She had transformed, become something more than herself, become extraordinary. The Queen of Spades. You have come to watch this man die, she announced. But I know you, people of the Tearling. You do not come to watch a hanging. You come for blood.
Aye, hundreds of voices shouted back. Make him bleed, lady. Give him to us.
No. Something seemed to be unfurling inside Kelsey, unfolding stealthily, like a dark pair of wings opening in the night, and she wanted to spread them wide, feel their span. Always she had been a child of the light, loving the warm sun through the cottage windows when it felt as though all things were right and kind. But the world was also full of darkness, a cold gulf that beckoned. The people hungered for violence. And suddenly, Kelsey wanted more than anything to give it to them.
Corruption, Carlin's voice, a dim echo long ago in the morning gleam of the library. Corruption begins with a single moment of weakness.
But Kelsey was not weak. She was strong. Stronger than Carlin could ever have imagined. Her entire being seemed to be filled with bright light.
Arlen.
It was only a whisper, but Fawn jerked around to face her, a marionette pulled by invisible strings.
I own him, Kelsey realized, her mind a dark marvel. Every cell, every molecule. I could force him to speak. I could force him to tell me everything I want to know.
But that was nonsense. The time for talk had come and gone.
Lady?
Mace touched her arm, and Kelsey turned to see that he was offering the third noose in one hand. But she ignored it, staring at Thorn, memorizing his form, learning his outlines. He watched her placidly, and Kelsey saw that he felt no regret, even now. In the bleak white landscape of his mind, he was certain that he had acted justifiably, that no man would have done any better. 17 long years of facilitating the shipment. But no, Thorn's role had been even worse. Deep within his mind, Kelsey found a bright flash of memory. A hand holding out a pen, a smooth, persuasive voice speaking in murmurs.
I'm afraid you have no choice, Majesty. There's no better option.
Fury coiled inside Kelsey, a sick fury that seemed to come from nowhere, descending like an animal with ragged claws and needle teeth. She tasted blood on her tongue. A dark slash opened just above Fawn's left eye. He cried out, clapped a hand to his forehead, and Kelsey watched with pleasure as blood spilled between his fingers and ran down his cheek. The crowd broke its silence now, howling in delight, pushing toward the scaffold. Kelsey leaned forward, heedless of Penn's restraining grip on her dress, and grasped Thorne's hair, tipping his head back. Bright blue eyes stared up at her from a face tacky with blood.
"I have news for you, Arlen. We're on my chessboard now."
Another slice appeared across Thorne's cheek, opening all the way from his hairline to the corner of his mouth. Thorne groaned, and Kelsey felt that winged thing inside her growing, heaving, desperate to break its bonds. She slashed at Thorne's neck, dangerously near the jugular, and watched crimson bloom across the white linen of his shirt. Thorne screamed, and the sound was music to Kelsey's ears, the crowd's approval roaring around her, lifting her up. She saw herself as they must see her, a beautiful woman, long dark hair snapping in the wind, a figure of great power and... was it terror? Kelsey hesitated, seeing the scene before her from another angle, as though a third person stood beside her, observing dispassionately. Thorne was bleeding from half a dozen deep wounds. He had fallen to his knees. The crowd had pushed farther up against the scaffold in its eagerness now, some of them shinning up the supports and reaching for Thorne, their hands grasping at his legs. But they shied away from Kelsey. Even the most eager took care that their hands should not come within range of her, not even to brush the hem of her dress. Terror? Yes, it must be. And Kelsey's mind went out to the black shadow of the Mort army, somewhere in the floodplain between the Cadell and the Crythe. My kingdom, she thought, and the wings inside her spread wide, prepared for some unimaginable flight. Briefly, her mind skipped backward to that night when Kib had lain dying, when she had snatched him back. That was power, yes, but it would not save the Tearling. Her kingdom was laid bare, ripe for slaughter, and she had nothing to offer but this darkness. The black wings folded, enclosing Kelsey in their embrace, and she nearly sighed at the relief she found there. A bottomless fathom where no light ever shone, where all choices were easy, because all choices were won. She returned to Thorne, pushing past his skin, seeking the meat beneath. Her mind had sharpened into a killing blade, and she launched into the creature in front of her, slashing everything within her reach, feeling a sweeping excitement as tissue shredded away from bone. Thorne howled, his body becoming misshapen as the inner upheaval played out across his skin. Blood gouted from his nose, spattering the hem of Kelsey's dress, but she barely noticed. She was already digging into the meat of his chest, looking for his lungs. She found one, constricted it, and felt it pop with sickening ease. More blood poured from Thorne's mouth, and at the sight of scarlet dripping down his chin, Kelsey felt it again, a fainting sort of pleasure, akin to what she felt when Penn touched her at night. But this was more visceral, like a punch to her core. Thorne's other lung collapsed, and he fell forward, writhing, on the scaffold. The crowd screamed with delight, and the sound lifted Kelsey up. Her entire body felt charged, electric. "I am the Queen of the Tearling," she shouted, and the crowd immediately fell silent. Looking over them, their open mouths, their wide eyes all fixed on her, Kelsey felt as though she held the world in her hands. She had felt so before, but could not remember when. She placed her boot on Thorne's neck and pressed down hard, liking the way he writhed, liking the feel of his neck beneath her boot. "The price of treachery in my Tearling. Mark and remember it." Thorne's neck snapped. He gave a final gagging cough and seemed to seize, his spine arching. Then he was gone. Kelsey felt him go like leaves in a wind, but the wild darkness inside her didn't diminish. Instead, it pushed harder, demanding that she find another traitor, more blood. Kelsey drove it back, sensing that here was a seductive thing to be carefully controlled.
She looked down at Thorne's corpse, at the muddy mark of her boot on his neck. The darkness in her mind faded to white, then disappeared.
"To the Queen!" a woman's voice shouted.
"To the Queen!"
Kelsey looked up and saw cups upraised all across the crowd. They had come prepared to celebrate when the deed was done. She had given the crowd what they wanted, what they needed. But still, Kelsey hesitated, a trickle of anxiety fermenting in her belly now.
Who did those things? The Queen of Spades?
Or me? Mace placed a cup in her hand, and Kelsey suddenly understood that the drinking was a ritual. She raised the cup to the crowd, wondering if there were any specific words she was supposed to say. No, she was the Queen. She could make up her own words, her own ritual, and they would trump everything that had come before.
"The health of my people," she shouted. "The health of the Tearling."
The crowd roared the final words back to her and then drank. Kelsey took a sip and realized that although Mace had come prepared, he was no fool. The liquid in her cup was only water, but it tasted sweet somehow, and Kelsey drained it. When she turned to give the cup back, she found Mace still holding the noose in his other hand. Although his face was blank, Kelsey sensed disapproval beneath.
"Well, Lazarus?"
"You've changed, lady. I never thought to see you bow to the will of the mob."
Kelsey flushed. The realization that Mace could still do that, make her feel ashamed with a single cutting remark, was unwelcome.
"I bow to no one."
"That I can well believe."
Mace turned away, and Kelsey grabbed his arm, desperate to make him understand.
"I haven't changed, Lazarus. I've grown older, that's all. I'm still me."
"No, lady,"
Mace sighed, and the sigh seemed to pass through Kelsey, a breath of doom on cold wings.
"Tell yourself whatever pleasing stories you want, but you're not the girl we took from the cottage. You've become someone else."
Chapter 10 Father Tyler.
"Always we think we know what courage means. If I were called upon, we say, I would answer the call. I would not hesitate.
Until the moment is upon us. And then we realize that the demands of true courage are very different from what we had envisioned long ago, on that bright morning when we felt brave." Father Tyler's collected sermons from the Arvath archive. The Arvath staircase was made of solid stone, bleached white stone that had been mined from the rocks around Crossing's End. But with each step, Tyler became more careful, tormented by an irrational certainty that the stone staircase would squeak beneath his feet. He climbed slowly, dragging his broken leg. Occasionally he passed one of his brothers going down the staircase, and they gave him only the most cursory glance before moving on. Tyler's position as keep priest gave him latitude, made it plausible that he might be invited up to the Holy Father's private quarters so late at night. But Tyler had to count the landings in order to know where he was. He had never climbed so high in the Arvath. He didn't know whether he would be coming back down. When he reached the ninth floor, he darted away from the staircase, concealing himself in a recess that stood across the hall. The opulence of his surroundings made Tyler dizzy, for the decor on this level was a far cry from the plain stone walls and hand-woven rugs that graced the brothers' quarters downstairs. Gold and silver shone in the torchlight, candle stands, tables, statuary. The floors were Cadarese marble. The walls were draped with red and purple velvet. The hallway continued for perhaps 50 feet before it turned left toward the Holy Father's private quarters. There was no one in sight, but Tyler knew that around the corner he would surely find guards and acolytes, at least several of them, near the Holy Father's door. It was just after 2 o'clock in the morning. If Tyler was lucky,
The Holy Father would be sleeping, but it seemed too much to hope for that his guards and servants should do the same. Even on tiptoe, Tyler's shoes made a scuffling sound that seemed deafening in the cavernous hallway. "I will grab my books and be gone," he repeated to himself. "Only 10 books." Tyler had already chosen them so that he would not be tempted to exceed his capacity. He liked the historical significance of the number 10, the symmetry with the crossing. Books were one of the few personal items William Tyr had allowed his people. 10 books apiece. If they tried to sneak other items aboard, he left them behind. It was only Arcana, one of thousands of tiny pieces of information about the crossing that Tyler had picked up during his lifetime. But he had never forgotten a single one. "If I survive this," Tyler decided, "I will write the first history of the crossing. I'll bind it myself and present it to the Queen for printing." That was a good thing to tell himself, a grand dream. But the Queen's ambition to create a printing press had come to naught so far. No one in the Tierling had any idea how to begin building such a thing. There was no mechanism for broad distribution of the written word. "There will be." Tyler blinked. The voice was implacable. He believed it. Peering around the corner, he saw that fear had made him overly cautious. Only 2 men stood in front of the Holy Father's door, and they were acolytes. Not the well-armed guards who accompanied the Holy Father whenever he left the safety of the Avath. If Brother Matthew had still been the Holy Father's right hand, this would have been much more difficult. But Brother Matthew had been executed Sunday past, and these 2 on the door appeared young and soft, perhaps not yet taken into the Holy Father's confidence. They looked up sleepily as he approached. "Good evening, brothers. I must speak to His Holiness." The acolytes exchanged nervous looks. One of them, a boy barely out of his teens with a catastrophic overbite, replied, "His Holiness is not receiving visitors this evening." "The Holy Father told me that I was to come to him with this news immediately." They shot each other another uncertain glance. Indecisive, these 2, and poorly trained. It was another marked difference between Anders and the old Holy Father, who never let his people represent him to the world until they were as competent as himself.
"Surely it can wait until morning?" the second youth asked.
He was even younger than the first, still young enough for pimples to dot his face in small clusters.
"It cannot," Tyler answered firmly. "This is news of the most vital importance."
They turned away from him and held a huddled conference. Despite his anxiety, Tyler was amused to hear the 2 of them begin a game of rock, paper, and scissors to decide who would go in. After 3 tries, the young man with the overbite lost and slipped, white-faced, through the great double doors. The other acolyte did his best to appear professional while they waited, but he yawned continually, ruining the illusion. Tyler could only pity him, this boy growing up directly under Anders' eye and tutelage. He could not imagine how the boy would conceive of his church, his god.
"I should check your bag,"
the boy ventured after a few moments. Tyler held out his satchel, and the acolyte peered inside. But all he saw was Tyler's old Bible, a heavy hardcover given to him by Father Allen on his 8th birthday. The acolyte handed the satchel back, and Tyler replaced the strap over his head, settling the bag across his body. Sometime in the last few minutes, his fear had begun to ebb, leaving something electric in its wake. His heart seemed too big for his chest. The other acolyte's head appeared from the doorway, and Tyler could not mistake the look of relief on his face. Tyler was wanted.
"Please, come in."
He opened the door wide, and Tyler followed him into what was clearly a common room of some sort, an enormous chamber with high ceilings and thick rugs. Oil painting covered the walls, and velvet sofas were scattered throughout the room.
The acolyte did not look at any of these things, keeping his gaze straight ahead. But Tyler, who glanced around the room in curiosity, let out a startled gasp. To his right, a woman lay sprawled on a low sofa, completely naked, her limbs thrown every which way to conceal nothing. It was the first time in his life that Tyler had seen a woman's bare breasts, and he turned away quickly, embarrassed both for her and for himself. But the woman seemed entirely oblivious of their presence, her eyes wide and unfocused.
"Please, wait here," the acolyte told him,
and Tyler halted abruptly as the boy continued onward toward a large arched doorway at the far end of the room. Left alone, Tyler was unable to stop staring at the woman on the sofa, at her breasts, and the dark triangle between her thighs. Although he felt no lust, his age had moved him past that particular indignity, the sight of these things was fascinating. The woman had long dark hair that fell in ribbons over the edge of the sofa, and she returned his gaze without shame. As Tyler's eyes adjusted to the dim candlelight, he spied a syringe within the crease of her elbow, the head of a needle still buried deep in her arm. Having seen this, he could not help seeing other things, a vial of white powder still uncapped on the low table between them, a spoon bent and twisted through long misuse, deep bruising that went halfway up the woman's other arm. She was not young, this woman, but her body was still lithe. And to Tyler's eye, the needle in her arm seemed a ruinous thing, a perversion of potential.
"Who are you?" she asked Tyler, her voice wet and slurred. "Never seen you before."
"Tyler."
"You a priest?"
"Yes."
She straightened a bit, propping herself on one elbow. Her gaze had sharpened slightly.
"Never seen a naked woman before, eh?"
"No," Tyler replied, dropping his gaze to stare at the ground. "I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry. I don't mind if they look."
"Who's they?"
"Oh."
The woman looked off into the corner, her eyes turning vague again.
"All of them. Other priests. The ones who visit. They never stop at looking."
Something turned over in Tyler's stomach.
"You won't touch, will you?"
"No."
"Want a hit?"
"No, thank you."
Tyler pulled the ancient Bible from his bag, fingering the edges of the cover, touching the pages. It felt very solid in his hand.
"What's your name?"
"Maya."
"Tyler, what brings you to me so late at night?"
But the Holy Father already knew. His face radiated good humor. He wore a hastily tied robe of black silk, and his hair was mussed, but he made no attempt to repair his appearance. And Tyler remembered suddenly that there was a second woman here, that the Holy Father kept too. He had forgotten to include the women in his calculations, and their presence would make his enterprise more dangerous. For a moment, Tyler considered begging off, lying to the Holy Father, and then simply leaving the Arvath under the cover of night. But then, thinking of his books, he screwed up his courage, set his face in grim lines, and announced,
"It's done, Your Holiness."
"The Queen took the substance?"
"Yes."
"So late?"
"The Queen sleeps little these days, Your Holiness."
This at least was true. Tyler, who had spent several recent nights on his favorite sofa in the Queen's library, had been awakened more than once by the Queen herself, touring her bookshelves, touching each book in turn. She wandered the wing, trailed doggedly by Pen Olcott, but always she came back to her library for solace. She and Tyler were alike that way, but whatever the Queen was looking for, she did not find it. Except for the times when she fell into her strange catatonic states, and thank God the Holy Father knew nothing of those. She seemed to sleep very little.
She took it in tea, perhaps an hour ago. Well, this is splendid news, Tyler.
The Holy Father clapped him on the back, and Tyler had to fight not to shrink away. Maya was staring at the two of them now, her eyes narrow and sharp.
My books, Your Holiness.
Well, I think we'll wait and make sure the deed is done, Tyler. You understand?
The Holy Father grinned, a predator's grin that consumed his whole face. Tyler's hands tightened on his Bible, but he nodded.
May I not even have a glimpse of my books, Your Holiness? I have missed them.
The Holy Father stared at him, a moment that seemed very long.
Certainly, Tyler. Come with me. They're in my bedchamber.
From the corner of his eye, Tyler saw Maya's mouth drop open in dismay. Her presence could wreck everything, but there was no turning back now. The moment the Holy Father turned away, Tyler swung the Bible with all of his strength, the way a woodsman would swing an axe. The heavy book connected solidly with the Holy Father's head and knocked him sprawling, but the blow had not been enough. The Holy Father pushed himself to his hands and knees, drawing deep breath, preparing to shout.
Please, God, Tyler breathed.
He limped forward and raised the Bible and brought it straight down on the back of the Holy Father's head. The Holy Father dropped soundlessly to the rug, and this time he lay still. Tyler looked up and found Maya staring at him with wide eyes. He tucked the Bible back into his bag, raising his hands to show that he meant her no harm.
My books. He was lying, wasn't he? They're not here. They took them out a week ago, down to the basement.
This, more than anything else, told Tyler that the promise of a reward had been a lie. If he'd done the deed, the Holy Father would have, what, killed him? Tyler considered the man on the ground for a moment. He was breathing, Tyler noticed gratefully, before he saw the clear path, the smart move. The Holy Father would have handed him over to the mace.
Thank you, God, Tyler breathed, that I did not do it.
You're the Queen's priest, said Maya.
Yes.
Tyler edged toward the door, listening, but there was no noise from outside. Still, he should leave now, before the Holy Father regained consciousness, before the woman raised the alarm. He grasped the handle, but her voice stopped him.
Is the Queen good?
Tyler turned and saw that Maya's eyes had filled with alarming need. He had seen similar desperation long ago, out in the countryside, when dying parishioners would ask a still unordained Tyler to take their final confessions. For some strange reason of her own, Maya needed him to answer yes.
Yes, she's good. She wants to make things better.
Better for who?
For everyone.
Maya stared at him for a moment longer, then scrambled up from the sofa. Tyler was no longer embarrassed by her nakedness. In fact, for a few moments he'd forgotten all about it. Maya hurried over to the Holy Father's prone body, reached beneath him, and pulled a chain over his head. On the chain was a small silver key.
I need to leave, Tyler told her.
He did not want to abandon her here, she was so terribly troubled, but he could not take her with him, even if she wished to flee. Adrenaline had departed and was rapidly being replaced by the full realization of what he had done. His leg was even worse than he'd thought. Going up the stairs had strained it badly. The journey downward would be terrible.
My mum was a pro priest.
What?
A pro? A prostitute?
Maya crossed the room and crouched down in front of a glossy oak cabinet, her movements sure. Tyler barely recognized the languid addict of a few moments before.
Mum used to talk to us about the things she would do some day,
The one important thing that would wipe out all the years before. You only got one moment, Mum said. And when it came, you had to jump, no matter the cost.
I really need to.
E tells us about the invasion. Soon the Mort will be at the walls, and there are too many to hold back. It will take a miracle.
The lock clicked, and Maya opened the cabinet, then looked up at him, her face suddenly shrewd.
But they say the Queen is full of miracles.
When she stood, she held a large wooden box that had been burnished within an inch of its life. The sides gleamed deep cherry in the torchlight.
You have to give it back to her. It's wrong for him to keep it here.
What is it?
She opened the lid, and Tyler stared at the tear crown, which sat before him on a deep red cushion. Silver and sapphire glittered, sparkling reflections against the open lid of the box.
This is my moment, priest, Maya told him, shoving the box into his hands. Take it and go!
Tyler considered her for a moment, thinking again of the farmers he had known in his youth, dying in their huts, desperate to confess. And he wished that he could suspend time, even for an hour, to sit and talk to this woman who had never had anyone to listen. Her dark eyes were entirely clear now, and Tyler saw that they were beautiful, despite the lines that shrouded them like hoods.
Andy?
A woman's voice drifted from beyond the darkened archway, sleepy and confused.
Andy? Where'd you get to?
Go, priest, Maya ordered. I'll try to hold her, but you have very little time.
Tyler hesitated a moment longer, then took the box and tucked it alongside the Bible in his satchel. For a moment, grief over his books threatened to overtake him, but he would not give it space. It was a shame to even feel it now. He had lost his library, but the woman before him was risking her life.
Go,
she told him again. And Tyler limped for the doors, opening one of them just wide enough to let himself through. His last glimpse of Maya was fleeting, a quick flash of her staring at the vial on the table before he shut the door behind him. The two acolytes leaned against the wall on either side, so casually that Tyler wondered if they'd been eavesdropping. Overbite eyed him narrowly, then asked,
"Does the Holy Father want us?"
No, I think he means to retire for the rest of the night.
Tyler turned and started down the hall, but he only made a few steps before a hand fell on his shoulder.
What's in the bag?
Overbite asked.
My Bible. And what else?
My new robes,
Tyler replied, amazed at how easily the lie came to him.
The Holy Father has granted me a bishopric.
Both of them drew back, trading anxious glances. In the hierarchy of the Arvath, the Holy Father's personal aides, even the acolytes, carried more weight than any priest. But a bishop was another matter. Even the least powerful of the bishop's college was no one to argue with. As if by mutual consent, the two acolytes bowed and backed away.
Good night, Your Eminence.
Tyler turned and limped down the hallway. He guessed he had 2 minutes at most before they realized that his story was absurd. The Holy Father didn't keep spare sets of bishops' robes around to hand out like candy. And the other woman might raise the alarm at any time. Tyler paused at the top of the staircase, looking down at its concentric squares as one would face a mortal enemy. His leg was already throbbing, bright flashes of pain that traveled like a current from hip to toe. He wished he could take the lift, which ran a limited service at night to serve the Holy Father's level. They might agree to lower him down to the brothers' quarters, but he would have to wait for the lift to come. The platform was stowed on the lowest floor of the Arvath at night, and if the alarm was raised while he was still on it, he would be stuck, held between floors until Anders' guards came to take him. No, it would have to be the stairs. And considering the way Tyler's leg felt at the moment, he wouldn't get far before he had to hop. Tyler grimaced,
clenched his tongue between his teeth and started downward, leaning heavily on the handrail. His satchel bounced against his hip with each step, rhythmic drumming that did nothing to help his arthritis. One floor down, he clutched the bag, trying to keep it still, and felt the sharp contours of the wooden box inside.
I am part of God's great work.
This thought had not crossed his mind in a long time. He thought of the woman, Maya, and felt a wave of sick guilt crash through him. He had left her there, in front of a table full of morphia, to endure whatever punishment Anders might mete out. Two floors down. Now Tyler was hopping in earnest, holding his bad foot suspended in mid-air and clutching the handrail for dear life, using a tiny leap to propel himself down each step. His good leg was beginning to ache as well now, long unused muscles threatening to cramp. He didn't know what would happen if the leg seized before he finished the staircase. Three floors down. Both of his legs bellowed in protest, but he ignored them. Four floors down. The adrenaline had returned now, blessedly, singing all through his bloodstream as he began the final set of stairs. And against all odds, Tyler found himself grinning like a boy. He was a bookkeeper and an ascetic. A year ago, who would have guessed that he would be here, hopping like a bunny rabbit down the stairs? Rounding the second corner of the staircase, he caught a glimpse of slumped shoulders two flights down. A man's nearly bald head. His grin died in its tracks. Seth. Tyler paused, hearing a muffled sound high above. One moment more, and then the silence shattered in a deep thrum of bells. The alarm. Shouts echoed down the staircase, and now Tyler could hear pounding feet several floors up. They had not wanted to wait for the lift either. Tyler began hopping again, rounding the corner to the final flight of stairs. As he came closer, he saw that Seth was asleep, but perspiring, his skin waxy in the dim light. Seth was not healing. He was not meant to. Once every priest in the Arvath stopped having nightmares, once Seth had outlived his usefulness, the Holy Father would simply have him removed as neatly and cleanly as he had removed Tyler's books. Tyler reached the landing, and now he was confronted by the placard around Seth's neck, Abomination. The words seemed to reach deep into Tyler, opening a broad vista of things that should not be. When God's church had sprung up after the crossing, it had been a hard church, a reflection of its times. But a good church, it did not achieve its ends through hatred, through shame. And now... Seth, Tyler whispered, not knowing that he would speak until the words were out. Seth, wake up. But Seth continued to dream, his lips fluttering in the half-light. Seth! Seth woke with a jerk and a low cry. He looked up with bleary eyes. Ty? It's me. Tyler grabbed the placard and pulled it over Seth's head. Footsteps thundered above them. The Holy Father's guards could not be more than two floors away now. Tyler threw the placard over the edge of the railing where it fluttered downward for a moment before disappearing from sight. Come on, Seth. He got an arm around Seth's waist and pulled him off the stool. Seth hissed in pain but didn't draw away. Where are we going? Away from here. Tyler pulled him down the hallway. I can't carry you, Seth. My leg's bad. You have to help. I'll try. But Seth firmed up his own arm behind Tyler's back, lending support as the two of them limped along. Tyler's mouth stretched in a grim smile. What a pair we make, old lame and mutilated. But even this bit of gallows humour pricked at his memory, and now Tyler recalled something from his childhood, an illustration from one of Father Allen's tapestries. Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, on the road to Galilee, leading the blind, helping the lame, offering comfort to the leper. Tyler used to sit and stare for long minutes at that tapestry, the only art in Father Allen's house that did not depict a god of wrath. The Jesus in the tapestry had been mild and benevolent of face, and though the miserable of the world were crowded around him, he didn't turn away.
"This is my God," Tyler had realized. And now, hobbling down the high stone hallway more than 60 years later, he felt exalted at the memory. His broken leg buckled beneath him, and he thought he would pitch forward, bringing Seth down with him, both of them tumbling over the flagstones until they fetched up against the wall. But then, Tyler felt them, invisible hands gripping his legs, bolstering his knee, helping him to run.
"Seth," he gasped. "Seth, he's with us."
Seth gave a choked laugh, his hand clenched tightly on Tyler's thin ribs.
"What? Even now?"
"Of course now."
Tyler began to laugh as well, his voice high and hysterical.
"Great God, only a little farther."
The shouts behind them grew louder, and now Tyler could feel the footsteps of their pursuers beneath his feet, vibrating against the stone floor as they poured from the staircase. In every doorway there seemed to be a brother, just roused from sleep, staring at Tyler and Seth with wide eyes. But no one moved to stop them in their clumsy progress down the hallway. The invisible hands were gone now, and the two of them were supporting each other, their shuffling, limping gaits somehow finding symmetry. A three-legged race that carried them along. When they reached Tyler's door, they both limped inside, and Tyler shot the bolt. It took the Holy Father's guards nearly 2 minutes to find a piece of wood solid enough to break down the door. When the heavy oak rectangle finally tore free of its hinges, several guards crashed into Father Tyler's quarters, falling over each other in their haste and ending up in a pile on top of the busted door. They were quick to recover, to straighten up and look around, swords drawn, ready to meet resistance. But all they found was an empty room. Kelsey dragged herself up the last flight of steps, trying not to pant. She was carrying less weight, but the miraculous change to her exterior had not gotten her into good condition. Mace was beside her. Penn had gone on leave for the weekend. Kelsey had no opportunity to speak privately to him before he left, but she couldn't help wondering whether he would go to see the other woman. It was none of her business, Kelsey told herself, and yet 5 minutes later she would find herself thinking about it again. She had wanted this thing to mean nothing to either of them, but was quickly discovering that it didn't quite work that way. She reached the top of the stairs and found herself gazing over the high wall that bordered New London's eastern side. From here she could look out across the Cadell and over the Almont, now mottled green and brown in the late summer. Beneath the city's walls, just on the far side of the Cadell, lay the refugee camp, more than a mile of tents and hastily built shelters spread across the banks of the river. From this distance, the people in the camp were ant-like, but there were more than 500,000 of them down there. The Cadell provided plenty of water, but sewage was becoming a problem, and despite the huge stores that Mace had brought in, the camp would soon run out of food. It was the height of harvest season, but no one was farming the Almont. Even if the Tierling somehow made it through the invasion, fruit and vegetable stores would be decimated for years. Some families in the north, near the Fairwich, had elected to remain and take their chances, and so had a few isolated villages on the Caderese border. But most of the Tierling was now crammed in and around New London, and Kelsey sensed the kingdom before her as a vast wasteland under a grey sky. Nothing but deserted villages and empty fields. Haunted. Perhaps 10 miles distant, sprawled near the horizon, was the Tier Army, a cluster of tents that had faded from long use. The army was massed on the banks of the Cadell, at the point where the river suddenly bent to begin its twisting journey around New London. Her army appeared unimposing, even to Kelsey, and it was not helped by comparison with what lay on the horizon. A vast dark cloud, the subtle haze reflected from many miles of black tents, black banners,
and the innumerable hawks that now soared over the Mort camp at all times. Hall had caught the Mort napping beside Lake Karchmar, but that would never happen again. For now, the Mort had come up with some sort of sentinel species to overfly their camp. Unlike most Mort hawks, which would not cry out, these birds emitted an ungodly shriek whenever any of Berman's soldiers tried to approach. Several scouts had been caught in this manner, and now Berman was forced to keep an eye on the Mort from a distance. But not for long. They were coming, and they were coming fast. Hall's missives came without judgment, but Berman's were a constant stream of reprimands, and Kelsey knew that he was right. She had made a great mistake, one that her entire kingdom would suffer for, and although she was not certain that all other options would not have been greater mistakes, this one seemed to demand punishment. Every day she came out here to watch the Mort approach, to see the black cloud on the horizon draw nearer. It seemed no more than what she deserved.
"They're trying to cut the Cadell," Mace remarked beside her.
"Why? There's nothing on either side now."
"If they come up the bank and try to cross the river in front of the city, they would lose considerable numbers to our archers. But if they hold both banks, they can come with defences ready, be impervious to arrows. Then they can simply focus on scaling the walls and taking the bridge."
Even Mace was a pessimist now. There was no hope anywhere unless Kelsey could make it herself. The thoughts sickened her. When she looked in the mirror this morning, a beautiful brunette stared back at her. But not just any brunette. Lily's hair, Lily's face, Lily's mouth. The two of them were not identical, not by any means, but individual pieces were beginning to match. Kelsey and Lily were sharing a life. Now, it seemed, they would share a face as well. But Kelsey's eyes had never changed. They were still Raleigh eyes. Her mother's eyes, twin spots of deep green carelessness that had brought down an entire kingdom.
"Glory to the Queen!"
The shout came from below, from the bottom of the inner wall, where several members of her guard had blocked the stairwell. Kelsey peered over the edge and found a crowd of people gathered at the foot of the stairs. They waved furiously, a sea of upturned faces.
"They think I can save them."
Kelsey dug up a confident smile and waved back, then returned her attention to the Almont. She had never had any options, but that fact would earn her no leniency. When she was judged, as she surely would be, by history, if nothing else, there would be no mitigating circumstances. She stared at the dark sprawl on the horizon, not allowing herself to look away. Almost without thinking, she opened up a new wound on her calf, feeling a grim satisfaction as blood trickled down toward her ankle.
"Punishment." "Sir?"
Mace leaned over the edge of the staircase.
"What?"
"Messenger from General Bermond."
"Send him up."
Kelsey turned away from the Almont as Bermond's messenger reached the top of the stairs. Army messengers really were extraordinary. The man had run up 5 flights of stairs, but he was barely even out of breath. He was young and lithe, a sergeant by the copper pin at his collar, and his eyes widened as he caught sight of Kelsey. But this effect was no longer gratifying, if it ever had been. She signalled the man to speak, then turned back to the Almont.
"Majesty, the General wishes to report that the Argive Pass has fallen."
Mace grunted beside her, but Kelsey kept her gaze pinned on the black cloud on the horizon, trying not to blink. "The Mort have already begun to bring supplies to the Argive. This will cut their resupply time considerably. Last night, over 1,000 reinforcements also came down the pass. They will reach the Mort line by tomorrow. The entire Mort army has now crossed the Clyde and taken the north bank of the Cadell, and the vanguard will soon push the Tyr away from the southern bank as well. The General estimates that this will happen in no more than 3 days. He believes they mean to follow the Cadell all the way to New London." The messenger paused,
and Kelsey heard the gulp of his Adam's apple bobbing up and down.
Continue.
General Bermond wishes me to report that the Tyr army has now lost over 2,000 men, more than a third of its forces.
Kelsey's eyes refused to stay open any longer, and she blinked, momentarily blotting out the horizon. But when she opened her eyes, the cloud was still there.
What else?
This is all I have to report, Majesty.
No good news. Of course not.
Lazarus, how long until the Mort reach the walls?
My guess, less than a week. Don't let the distance deceive you, lady. Even with Berman doing all he can, the Mort are capable of advancing 2 or 3 miles a day. They'll be here by the end of the month, no later.
Kelsey looked down at the refugee camp, that sprawling mess of hardship, inadequate shelter, the beginnings of starvation. That responsibility lay at her feet as well. She turned back to the messenger.
Advise Berman that we'll move the refugees inside the city. It will take at least 5 days. Berman is to hold the Mort off the camp until evacuation is complete. Then retreat and hold the bridge.
The messenger nodded.
Well done. Dismissed.
He scampered down the stairs and out of sight. Kelsey turned back to the Almont.
Arlish should be in charge of evacuating the camp. His people know names and faces down there.
Lady, I assure you.
Did you really think I wouldn't find out, Lazarus? His little minions are all over that camp, dealing narcotics like there's no tomorrow.
There is no tomorrow for these people, lady.
Ah, I knew it.
Kelsey turned to face him, feeling her temper grind into terrible life. But beneath was something even worse than anger. Shame. She craved Mace's approval. Always had, in the same way she had always longed for accolades from Barty. But Barty had approved of her without reservation. Mace made his approval more valuable, forcing Kelsey to earn it, and the knowledge that she had failed cut very deep.
I knew that sooner or later you would tell me that I fucked it all up.
Done is done, lady.
This was worse. Not only did Mace not approve, he didn't even want to discuss it. Kelsey's eyes watered, but she forced the tears back, furious.
I suppose you think I'm just like her.
You spend too much time dwelling on your mother, lady. That's always been a weakness of yours.
Of course it has, Kelsey shouted, mindless of the guards nearby. She overshadows everything I try to do here. I can't make a move without being hampered by her mistakes.
Perhaps, lady, but don't deceive yourself. You make your own mistakes as well.
Is this about Thorn?
His gaze slid away from hers, and Kelsey narrowed her eyes.
You cannot be serious.
Listen to me, lady. Listen very carefully.
Mace's face had paled, and Kelsey suddenly realized that the granite expression she had mistaken for resignation was actually anger, a deep, quiet anger that was somehow worse than the blustering rages she had seen from Mace once or twice before.
You have done many things that I would not have done. You are reckless. You do not consider all consequences. Nor do you take advice from people who are more informed than you. And yet I have never condemned any of your actions until now.
Why? She hissed. What makes Thorn so important?
It's not Thorn,
Mace roared. And Kelsey shrank back.
Stop being a child for once. It's you, lady. You have changed.
This?
Kelsey ran a hand down her face and neck.
This is what concerns you?
I wouldn't care if you transformed into the beautiful queen herself. But your new face is not the issue, lady. You are different.
Less naive?
No. More brutal.
Kelsey's jaw clenched.
And what of that?
Think it over, lady. There are worse things than becoming your mother.
Kelsey's temper snapped, and for several seconds she hovered within inches of picking Mace up and heaving him over the wall. She could do it, she knew. Thorne's execution.